This is the fourth day of this June 2015 seven-day session. We'll resume with our same text, the book Zen Letters, which are the teachings of Yuan Wu, 11th century Chinese Zen master. This is translated by J.C. Cleary and Thomas Cleary. This is halfway through a letter that we started yesterday. We know that you must be someone genuinely within the tradition before you can be fully familiar with the fundamental portion of the vehicle of the school that has come down from time immemorial. It's quite a complex sentence. So you have to be someone truly, let's say, embodying the tradition, the Zen tradition, before you can really know the fundamental. If you really have an entry into enlightenment, then you know when to start and when to stop, when to advance and when to withdraw, and you can distinguish what is permissible from what is not. Many people get snarled up in these types of decisions, when to start and when to stop. Maybe when to go to Doksan, when not to go to Doksan, when to stay up and sit during yaza, the late night sitting, when to go to bed. I know these are things that can give people a lot of doubts about what to do. When to advance, when to withdraw. The best thing, and this isn't so easy necessarily, the best thing is to absorb oneself in one's practice, to get underneath the waves of yes and no, this and that, and somehow just find one's way into accord with what the situation calls for at that time, which may be different on day three than it is on day seven. And you can distinguish what is permissible from what is not. This points to our native sense of the fitness of things, and ultimately to Shila, the translation of morality or upright conduct. In Zen, we understand that ultimately, we all know what will cause harm and what will not cause harm, largely. There are always new complex ethical issues that are coming down the pike regarding breakthroughs in science, ethical genetics, genetically modified, or all kinds of things that are ancestors didn't have to deal with, and these can really leave us stymied. Many of them we don't really have to make a decision about. They don't concern us. And they may concern us, but it's not in our hands to have to sort out these things. You can distinguish what is permissible from what is not. Leaving behind all leakages, day by day you get closer to the truth, and more familiar with it. Leakages is an old Buddhist word, and we find in the text. It basically means thoughts, giving way to thoughts. As you go further, you change like a panther who no longer sticks to its den. You leap out of the corral. Then you no longer doubt all the sayings of the world's enlightened teachers. You are like cast iron. This is precisely the time to apply effort and cultivate practice and nourish your realization. Like a panther who no longer sticks to its den. Basically, not clinging to the conventional, not clinging even to what one has learned, but going beyond that to what is the Tao of that moment, which may be entirely different from what one has accrued through one's knowledge. That's why Zen has always been called the school of direct experience, a teaching beyond words. It's not a matter of learning rules. Yes, they can be useful up to a point, precepts and other guidelines, but then not to be attached to these things that we've learned. After that, you can kindle the inexhaustible lamp and travel the unobstructed path. You relinquish your body and your life to rescue living beings, to liberate living beings. You enable them to come out of their cages and eliminate their attachments and bonds. You cure them of the diseases of being attached to being enlightened, so that having emerged from the deep pit of liberation, they can become uncontrived, unencumbered, joyfully alive people of the way. This first sentence, you can kindle the inexhaustible lamp. This Dharma, this bottomless Dharma, this teaching of Dharma gates beyond measure. There's no beginning to practice or end to enlightenment. No end to enlightenment. No beginning to enlightenment or end to practice. And this phrase, you cure them of the diseases of being attached to being enlightened. There's that word that can cause so much mischief in our minds, dividing the world into the enlightened and the unenlightened. It's a great disease. When you yourself have crossed over, you must not abandon the carrying out of your bodhisattva vows. You must be mindful of liberating all beings and steadfastly endure the attendant hardship and toil in order to serve as a boat on the ocean of all knowledge. Only then will you have some accord with the path. So perhaps this letter is... He's writing this letter to someone quite advanced, maybe even a teacher, who he feels obliged to remind that this practice is not for our own benefit alone. It's the whole point of this is to help others. This is what so many people uninitiated to meditation misunderstand about it. They think meditation is just a withdrawing from the world into one's own private, secure, blissful little state and just letting the world pass you by. There is a place, of course, when we're actually doing the formal meditation where we have withdrawn in a sense, in an ordinary outward sense. We're withdrawn. And then it's all for the purpose of getting up the way Shakyamuni did himself after his great enlightenment, where he is reported to have sat for 7 weeks and stand up and go out and help others, respond to people who are in need, whatever that may be. He continues, "Don't be a brittle pillar or a feeble lamp. Don't bat around your little clean ball of inner mystical experience. You may have understood for yourself, but what good does it do for others, really, is what's implied." Some of this writing is just dazzling. And kind of wonder what his teaching, how it would have sounded, were it just oral records of what he had said, records of what he had said orally. He had the luxury that anyone does when they're writing a letter of being able to craft his sentences. Don't bat around your little clean ball of inner mystical experience. There's a statement that I've quoted a few times in Taisho that comes to us in some book from Da Wei. Da Wei was this author, Yuan Wu's most famous disciple. And somewhere Da Wei, in one of his own writings, he quotes an ancient worthy as having said, "Having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar." No attachment to any notion of what one has realized. No attachment to any notion of specialness, of enlightenment. This is what we aspire to in Zen practice, to be rid of these categories in our own mind. Next letter. "Brave, spirited wearers of the patched robe possess an outstanding, extraordinary aspect. With great determination, they give up conventional society. They look upon worldly status and evanescent fame as dust in the wind, as clouds floating by, as echoes in a valley. Since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, they know that this level exists and they transcend birth and death and move beyond holy and ordinary." Since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past. Now this, I would infer, he's referring to good karma from the past. Deep affinity with the Dharma from past lives. And because of that, they know, he says, they know that this level exists. We can sometimes stop and wonder how close our relationship to the Dharma might have been, must have been in the past for us to have such a deep engagement with it now. Not that it's something we want to spend any time thinking about, but the law of cause and effect of karma would certainly suggest that those of us who stick with this practice longest do so out of faith that was nourished, cultivated long before this lifetime. You can imagine at the end of our life having this great resolve to continue the work, the unfinished work, and for all of us it's unfinished. Continue this unfinished work next time around, and now we have the chance. How wonderful. They know that this level exists, and they transcend birth and death and move beyond holy and ordinary. This is the indestructible true essence that all the enlightened ones of all times witness, the wondrous mind that alone the generations of enlightened teachers have communicated. To tread this unique path, to be a fragrant elephant or a giant golden-winged bird, it is necessary to charge past the millions of categories and types and fly above them, to cut off the flow and brush against the heavens. These illusions, these creatures, the golden, giant golden winged bird and fragrant elephant, obviously refer to some kinds of myths, old Buddhist myths. How could the enlightened willingly be petty creatures confined within distinctions of high and low and victory and defeat, trying futilely to make comparative judgments of instantaneous experience and being utterly turned around by gain and loss? So, and since so often these Zen writings, he's speaking rhetorically here, how could it be? How could an enlightened person be that turned around by gain and loss? For this reason, in olden times, the people of great enlightenment did not pay attention to trivial matters and did not aspire to the shallow and easily accessible. They aroused their determination to transcend the Buddhas and patriarchs. They wanted to bear the heavy responsibility that no one can fully take up, to liberate all living beings, to remove suffering and bring peace, to smash the ignorance and blindness that obstructs the way. They wanted to break the poisonous arrows of ignorant folly and extract the thorns of arbitrary views from the eye of reality. They wanted to make the scenery of the fundamental ground clear and reveal the original face before the empty aeon. The original face before the empty aeon, before time. They wanted to bear the heavy responsibility that no one can fully take up, to liberate all living beings. Again, this endless work. Some people, when they hear this, can feel dispirited. Okay, it's just an end. It's like Sisyphus pushing this rock up a mountain. But really, how wonderful that it's endless. What kind of teaching would it be if you could get to the end and get a diploma or something? There's no measure to the depth of this mind and our ability to realize this mind. He continues, you should train your mind and value actual practice wholeheartedly, exerting all your power, not shrinking from the cold or the heat. Go to the spot where you meditate and kill your mental monkey and slay your intellectual horse. Make yourself like a dead tree, like a withered stump. Here he's describing the kind of mental stillness that can come through deep zazen, where the mind, we can finally get the mind to stop whirring. It's what Hakuin would sometimes refer to as the great surcease. Like a dead tree, like a withered stump. One can get an inkling of this. Usually it's late in Sesshin, maybe the last morning, the last night perhaps is what's most commonly understood. But this awe-inspiring silence. Where nothing is happening. Beyond happening, beyond coming and going. It's to the root, the source of all movement. Much later in this letter, he says, my teacher Wu Zhu often said, I have been here for 5 decades and I have seen thousands and thousands of Zen followers come up to the corner of my meditation seat. They were all just seeking to become Buddhas and to expound Buddhism. I have never seen a single genuine wearer of the patched robe. Well, even if we allow for some hyperbole here, he's pointing out that really everyone has further to go. And when he says all just seeking to become Buddhas and to expound Buddhism, I would take that to mean everyone's just trying to get this thing they think of as enlightenment and then to be able to become a teacher. How true this is. As we observe the present time, even those who expound Buddhism are hard to find. Much less any genuine people. The age is in decline and the sages are further and further distant. In the whole great land of China, the lineage of Buddha is dying out right before our very eyes. we may find one person or half a person who is putting the Dharma into practice, but we would not dare to expect them to be like the great exemplars of enlightenment, the dragons and elephants of yore. This lament of this Dharma ending age is one that crops up all through many Buddhist texts. There's an old kind of a legend attributed to the Buddha that there are these 400-500-year periods after the Buddha, where the Dharma sinks into greater decline until it disappears. It's still early yet to know whether that might happen. But it's it's easy for a teacher to lament the kind of average level of aspiration when so many come, but so few are chosen. But then he brings us out of this depression and with this other statement. Nevertheless, if you simply know the procedures and aims of practical application of the Dharma and carry on correctly from beginning to end, you are already producing a lotus from within the fire. There's never any final grade. We always can pick ourselves up and renew our practice. There's no final pass-fail measure. The important thing is to persevere, just carry on. You must put aside all the conditioning that entangles you. That's a lot. That covers a lot. All the conditioning that entangles you, all the mental attachments, the physical attachments, the petty desires, the emotional afflictions, the habits, the karma, in a word. He's saying we must continue working until full enlightenment. Then you will be able to perceive the inner content of the great enlightenment that has come down since ancient times. Be at rest wherever you are and carry on the secret, closely continuous, intimate level practice. The devas will have no road to strew flowers on. Devas is one of the six realms of unenlightened existence. Devas means the heavenly beings. Will have no road to strew flowers on, and demons and outsiders will not be able to find your tracks. This is what it means to truly leave home and thoroughly understand oneself. He's trying to hold up the potential to all the receiver of this letter, maybe a monk. He wants to, out of his deep compassion, to inspire them to reach, to attain what they're capable of reaching. Often in Asia, that would involve some degree of shaming of the monks. And that would work often. They would respond well to the threat of being shamed, bringing shame on one's family or one's temple. It's not our way here. Carry on the secret, closely continuous, intimate level practice. This is right. He's getting right in there with us in our bellies, in the Zendo. Closely continuous, trying to remove all gaps from this intense concentration, to become intimate. Intimate with Mu, intimate with the breath, intimate with whatever our questioning is, but ever more closely, meticulously concentrated. It is ultimately a matter of intimacy. How intimate are we with the practice we're working on? And to reach this intimacy, or in reaching this intimacy, we can get very, very fine and quiet in our work with the practice. And find our breath all but stopping. Very gentle, fine work. Here he's writing to someone else. I'll just pick up partway through. This fall, it happens that there is a big crop. You know, in these monasteries, they had to grow their own food, of course, and they had sometimes fields of vast acreage where the monks would get out and work the fields. This fall it happens that there is a big crop. We have asked you to oversee the harvest, and now that you are about to go, you have asked for some words of instruction, so I have told you about the foregoing set of circumstances. What is important is to respect the root and extend it to the branches. There he's using language of the man he's writing to, this farmer. Respect the root and extend it to the branches. This will benefit both root and branches, and also illumine the legitimate and fundamental task of people of complete enlightenment and comprehensive mastery. If you work hard to carry this out, you will surely improve. The root, could say, is no mind. Zazen, Zen practice, the root practice of Zen, detaching from thoughts. And then the branches are secondary practices, devotions, rituals, ceremonies. The branches of no mind are the mind as we ordinarily think of it and its many functions. The branches of no words are words. in general, to practice the way and seek out the mystery, you must have a great basis in faith. You use this faith to believe in a deep sense that this matter does not lie in words or in any of the myriad experiential states. You could say any of the myriad states of mind that we can encounter in doing zazen. Sesshin is in a sense, is just passing through one mind state after another. And experience, becoming experienced in Sesshin work means recognizing that they're all mind states. That whatever we encounter is not to be hung on to or made much of. The positive mind states, the perhaps euphoric, blissful mind states, the negative, the discouragement, none of it is our essential nature. It is all just, it's all transitory states, nothing we want to get bogged down in. This matter does not lie in words or in any of the states of mind. In fact, in truth, the way is right where you stand. Put aside the crazy and false mind that has been concocting your knowledge and understanding, and make it so that nothing whatsoever is weighing on your mind. Fully take up this matter in your perfect, wondrous, inherent nature, which is fundamentally pure and quiescent. Subject and object are both forgotten, and the road of words and thoughts is cut off. You open through and clearly see your original face. Make it so that once found, it is found forever and remains solid and unmoving. Unmoving. This original mind, how could it move? From what to what? When there is nothing outside this mind. It's like, it's the ground. It is the very ground of it all. It feels like this is where we should stop, so I will now recite the four vows.